crawled down the basement stairs, which wasn't easy. I put on some clothes, ran a comb through my hair, checked my bed sheets for nocturnal emissions, and went upstairs for a Pop-Tart. We only had the watermelon kind. Jody had begged me to buy them for her because of the pink and green frosting, and then she hated the taste. So did I. I grabbed the frosted flakes and ate a couple handfuls out of the box, then washed them down with milk and two beers. Elvis started barking outside. I expected to panic. It could have been Amber coming back. But the red dogs had taken the edge off. Too much, maybe. I slammed into the corner of the kitchen table as I turned to get Dad's coat off the back of a chair. I closed my eyes and swore. When I opened them again, Misty was standing inside the back door in baggy denim overalls with a black tube top underneath. Her hair was in a sloppy ponytail. A small purse made of see-through purple plastic hung off one shoulder. Inside it, I could see a lipstick, a Little Debbie zebra cake, and a pocket knife. "Are you okay?" she asked. "Fine," I answered, wincing. She didn't say anything else, or move a muscle. I limped around the table and thought about going out the back way, but it would have meant asking her to move. "What are you doing here?" I growled, sounding braver than I felt. "Did you miss the bus? Where's Jody?" "It's the last day of school," she said. "All we're going to do is clean out our lockers and watch a video." "Something educational, I hope." "It's based on a book," she offered. "Moby Dick?" She regarded me blankly. "Pet Cemetery." "My tax dollars hard at work," I said under my breath as I slipped my arms into Dad's coat. "I heard your fight with Amber last night." "Yeah, well..." I swallowed hard. I looked all around the room. I emptied Jody's cereal bowl into the sink. I crushed my beer cans and tossed them in the trash. I opened the refrigerator door. "What did you hear?" I asked with my head inside. "You screaming at her to put her clothes on?" I laughed. I laughed a second time. I had to bite my tongue to keep from laughing for the rest of my life. "You must have heard wrong. Why'd you sleep in a doghouse?" "Purely for kicks," I pulled out of the refrigerator. "I don't care what you and Amber do," she said. It took all my strength not to look at her, but the effort was wasted. I felt the dark, unblinking eyes on me. I felt them reduce me to a boy again and drag me inside with the irresistible lure of black blasted holes in the ground and gutted houses. She meant what she said. Not because she was depraved or forgiving or a victim herself, but because she had lost the ability to be moved if she had ever possessed it in the first place. She could still care, though. She cared by not caring. It was her highest compliment. "I've got to get to work," I said. "How about taking me to get a tattoo?" she suggested, "since I've already missed the bus and all." "Forget it. I already told you you can't get one." "I thought maybe you'd change your mind." "Why would I do that?" She shrugged. Her shrugs conveyed more meaning than most sermons. I thought I knew what she was trying to tell me. I stared back at her in disbelief. Was she trying to blackmail me into letting her get a tattoo because of what she thought she heard going on between me and Amber? Or maybe she was implying that she'd shoot me. Another bout of laughter rose to my lips and I swallowed it back. I had hidden the gun. "No way." "Why?" "It won't ever come off," I said. But even before the words were out of my mouth, I realized how stupid it was to care about a scar on her surface. I tried again. "You're too young to make a decision that you'll have to live with for the rest of your life, and I don't feel comfortable making it for you." "Okay." She walked over to the cupboard and took out a glass. "Okay," I echoed. "I can respect that," she explained, crossing the kitchen to the fridge. "I thought you were going to lecture me on how sleazy it is, or maybe try and stop me because you're on a parental power trip. But if that's your reason..." She pulled out a pitcher of blue Kool-Aid. "I guess I understand." She poured and took a long drink. The band of pink stones around her wrist looked dull and cloudy in sunlight. Only artificial light in a dark room seemed to be able to make them glitter anymore. "We're not that different, you know," she said to me over the top of her glass. "The way we think?" "Huh?" "We're both sort of weird. I'm not the way a girl's supposed to be, and you're not the way a guy's supposed to be." "What are you talking about?" "You don't like football. You don't like to mow. You keep that art book in your truck," she said flatly, taking a loud slurp between each observation. "Big fucking deal," I said. "Almost all the artists in that book are men. There's nothing wrong with a guy liking art. There's nothing wrong with a girl liking to hunt." "Who said there was?" "Dad thought there was." She finished her drink. It left a slight blue tinge to her lips, reminding me of this tiny purple-faced infant hooked to a respirator I had seen in a magazine in Betty's waiting room. The caption warned smokers not to reproduce. "Dad loved taking you hunting," I reminded her. "No, he didn't," she said without emotion. "He took me because I wanted to go, but he always wished I was you." "That's bullshit." "No, it's not." "You're saying he didn't like me because I didn't want to go hunting with him, and he didn't like you because you did?" "Something like that." Her sullen brown stare fixed vacantly on the bottom of her empty glass. A significant silence passed. "I tried to make him love me," she said. The words clanged in my ears like a sprung trap. I wanted to run. But she looked up and her stare stamped down on me like heavy metal dull-edged teeth that would only tear if I tried to get away. "He did love you. Not like he loved Mom." A clammy feeling started in my crotch and climbed up my spine to settle on the top of my crusty scalp. "That's a different kind of love," I said, trying to keep the rising revulsion out of my voice.
"He never hit her. Did you ever wonder about that? He never hit her, not a single time. That's probably why she didn't care that he hit us."
And there it was, the final answer. I saw it buried in my sister's muddy eyes. The pain and confusion and hatred of someone forsaken. There had never been an incestuous love she had been willing to kill for. There had never been a deadly loyalty for a daddy who spent quality time with her when he wasn't beating her. Dad had nothing to do with it. The betrayal had occurred between mother and child. Misty's years of watching animals in the wild had taught her what she could expect and what she was owed. Her own mother had violated the simplest, most fundamental, instinctual law of nature. She had failed to protect her young. I licked my lips. And Mom had known that Misty knew her crime. She had known since the day Misty dropped the murdered kitten at her feet and started wearing its collar like a purple heart. The pale speckled face with its Maybelline war paint turned toward the window. "It's a nice day. I can't believe Amber didn't skip so she could lay out. I bet you're disappointed." My stomach lurched, and I tasted milky beer in the back of my throat.
I swallowed it down. It came up again. I reached for one of the kitchen chairs to steady myself.
Misty was going to terrorize me. Not with the threat of revealing what was going on between Amber and me, but with the threat of encouraging it. I thought about Jody's notes, and I wanted to cry. Misty was teaching her it was okay. They were all going to be on Amber's side. My teeth started chattering and I clenched my jaw shut. I saw my future. I saw Jody's. I had to do something. Then I remembered Misty had her own terrible secret.
"I know what you did," I told her.
She kept staring out the window.
"Did you hear me?"
"Nothing."
"Don't you have anything to say to that?"
She slowly pulled her stare away from the window and aimed it at me, pitying my dumb animal fate, but savoring my dumb animal fear.
"You're the one who should have done it," she said.
This time when the milk and beer came up, I couldn't hold it back. I lunged for the sink. Misty stepped aside.
Once I started throwing up, I couldn't stop. It was like my body had finally found something it was good at. I stopped to rest at one point and laid my cheek against the cool steel faucet. In the other room, I heard the TV go on. I was fine once I got to work. I did well. I calmly took the abuse from my boss at Barclays. I agreed with him that jobs were hard to come by around here, and I was a dumbass for risking this one. I told him I understood that I was going to be fired if I was ever late again. On the road, I was the friendliest son of a bitch who had ever delivered a refrigerator anywhere in the tri-state area. I made small talk and chit-chat with every housewife and toddler we came across. I even participated in tits and ass commentary with Ray. I didn't get upset when various people throughout the day told me I smelled like a barn or asked me why I was wearing a coat. We were coming back from our last delivery when the big one hit. The one I did not survive. 6 seconds was a liberal estimate. I didn't even get two. I didn't get a chance to look up and see the sky explode into 1,000 suns. My explosion happened on the inside. Ray was driving. I wasn't conscious of the way I reacted, but it must have been bad because he made me get out of the truck on a busy road on the outskirts of town a good 5 miles from the store. Once the pain in my head dulled enough for me to catch my breath and my limbs stopped shaking enough for me to move with purpose, I started walking. I didn't look at the cars and trucks that sped by me. I didn't look at the soft blue sky above me or the long gray line stretching out endlessly at my feet. I found a star in the distance, a green and orange 7-Eleven sign, and set my sights on it. I went straight to the payphones attached to the side of the store and called Betty. Her answering machine picked up and said she was at her other office. I could leave a message or call her there. I repeated the number it gave. I started to dial and forgot it. I called her county office again. I repeated the number. I started to dial and forgot it. I called again. I ran out of quarters. I had a dollar in my pocket. I went inside and got quarters. I counted them. 4. 4 quarters. Good, I told the cashier. I went outside and called her county office again. I got the number. I hit 7 buttons and closed my eyes. Another answering machine picked up, and I started to cry. Even after the beep, I kept crying. I couldn't think of a better message.
Hello? Hello?
Betty's real voice came on the other end.
Hello? Who is this? Is something wrong?
I need help, I sobbed.
Who is this?
I don't know.
Harley?
Yeah. I stopped and sniffed and wiped my nose with the sleeve of Dad's coat. That sounds right.
Harley, where are you?
I don't know.
What's wrong? What's happened?
I need help.
What happened?
She...
Who?
She...
She who?
A savage pain ripped through my head, obliterating my thoughts, leaving me mute and stupid.
Harley, where are you?
I could only cry.
Are you at home?
I shook my head at the phone.
At work?
7-Eleven, I whispered.
7-Eleven, she repeated. You mean the store?
I nodded at the phone.
The old one or the new one?
The green one, I sniffed.
Harley,
she sounded frustrated.
I'm with a patient right now.
A real patient, I said.
Can you get to me? I'm at my office.
Your real office, I said.
It's less real than the one I see you at. It's 475 Saltwerk Street, between Maple and Grant. It's a big white house with a bright red door. Do you think you can find it?
I hung up the phone and started walking again. I was sweating like a pig by the time I got there. The house wasn't big. It was huge. The ones around it were big. The floor inside was a dark, fathomless wood polished until it looked liquid. A banister of the same wood wound its way up a staircase in front of me. Paintings of pale pink ballerinas and gem-colored gardens hung on the walls papered in cream. 2 old-fashioned chairs with striped velvet cushions sat on either side of a doorway I couldn't see into. Holy shit, I thought to myself.
Hello?
A female voice called, not Betty's. I was afraid to step off the plush throw rug onto the floor for fear of drowning.
Is somebody there?
A woman came out of the room I couldn't see into. She was smiling politely, but then her mouth gaped open a little, and her eyes grew wide with concern.
Are you Harley?
She asked.
Yeah.
Come in, she said. Dr. Parks is going to be so relieved to see you.
Dr. Parks? I wondered.
Betty,
she explained. She made a move to touch me, then thought better of it.
Do you want to take off your coat?
No, thanks.
She told me to follow her, and I did, to a room at the end of the hallway. Betty was sitting in it behind a bed-sized heads of state kind of desk, surrounded by shelves and shelves of books. She was on the phone. She hung up immediately.
Harley, thank God,
she said, and came out from behind the desk. She had on a respectable skirt the color of toasted coconut, nylons and heels, and a sleeveless cream silk top with pearls. A pair of polished yellow-gold squares on her ears shone through her sterling hair whenever she moved her head.
It's been almost 2 hours since you called. How are you?
You don't need that government job, do you? I said.
She followed my gaze around the room.
That depends on what you mean by need, she answered me. I don't need it for financial reasons, no.
The chairs and the couch in this office were too nice for me to sit on, so I stood, even after she asked me to sit, even after she said please. She sat in an overstuffed leather chair like a caramel-dipped marshmallow.
What happened, Harley? You mentioned a she. You never got back to me after your visit with your mother. How did that go?
I blinked sweat out of my eyes. Or maybe it wasn't sweat. I remembered eyes are made out of water. She. I started up again.
Yes, Harley,
Betty said pleasantly.
She who?
She. I said again. She. She.
Yes?
She urged me.
She.
I licked my lips, swallowed, took a deep breath. She. I shook my head in frustration. I used to, I tried. Betty leaned forward.
Used to what?
We used to.
Used to what?
I fell to my knees and covered my face with my hands. Betty joined me on the floor. I felt her hands on my back. I felt them through Dad's coat.
Who?
She said. Amber. Her name finally left me like a tumor carved from my brainstem. I could think and speak again. Used to touch me when we were kids. I remember. She used to touch me in bed. She used to come to my bed and touch me.
Where did she touch you?
Betty asked.
You know where!
I screamed at her.
You need to say it.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do. You need to say it out loud in order to confront it so it can go away.
It's not ever going to go away.
It can fade to almost nothing, Harley. It can, I promise you.
I put my face back in my hands.
She touched you where?
I thought about who I was talking to.
My penis,
I said hoarsely.
Did it give you an erection?
I didn't answer.
Did it?
Yes.
Did you ejaculate?
I buried my face deeper.
Yes,
I sobbed.
Did you touch her?
No,
I moaned and looked up at her.
No. No, I swear I didn't. I never even looked at her. She was behind me. She came into my bed.
Why did she come into your bed?
I started crying harder. I couldn't stop shaking. Betty put her arms around me.
Think about it,
she said. She was afraid of Dad. I cried into her shoulder.
And you let her stay?
I nodded.
Why?
She asked, rocking me on the floor.
Think about it.
I was afraid of him too.
I want you to listen to me very carefully, Harley.
She let go of me and sat back on her heels. She waited for me to look at her.
You are not a bad person. You're not a freak or a pervert. There's nothing wrong with you or Amber. You were children reacting to debilitating emotional and physical abuse the only way you knew how, by turning to each other for comfort and pleasure.
I tried to cover my face again, but she grabbed my hands and held them in hers.
What made you remember, do you know? Did something happen?
I can't, I said, shaking my head.
Yes, you can. What happened?
She moved away for an instant and came back with a box of Kleenex. She pulled one out and handed it to me. She was in bed with me, I began haltingly. I was sleeping.
When?
Last night.
Did she touch you?
I don't know. I was sleeping. I wiped at my eyes and blew my nose. She didn't have clothes on, I volunteered.
Did you have an erection?
A shudder traveled from my toes to the top of my head and back again. I didn't look, I said. She sighed again, a weary sigh. I glanced at her. She was sitting on the floor with her legs tucked behind her. I had left wet stains on her silk blouse. I wondered if I had ruined it.
How did you react? She asked me.
What do you mean? I shouted at her, getting up from the floor and scrambling away from her. What kind of question is that? I'm not sick. I backed into the bookshelves.
I'm not sick. I'm not implying that you are.
She stood up too, but didn't approach me.
I'm thinking about Amber now.
Huh?
Amber, she said again. I'm concerned about how she must be feeling right now.
Amber, I shouted. It was all her idea. She wanted to do it.
She didn't want to do it, Harley. Try and understand. Your sister isn't the villain here. She's suffering as much as you are, maybe more.
More, I cried out.
How did you react to her advances?
I threw her off me. I screamed at her. I told her to get away. I ran away.
Where is Amber right now?
I looked out the window. The sun had fallen halfway down the sky. I was supposed to be somewhere, but I couldn't remember where. I don't know, I said. I think she went to school. Today's the last day. They got out early. What's the matter? She can take care of herself. Betty didn't look convinced.
Right now you're feeling repulsion, shame, guilt, she instructed me. Amber's feeling all that too, but she's also feeling rejection.
She started to the door.
Please sit, Harley. I don't think I've ever seen anyone look so tired in my entire life.
She walked out. I stared at the couch. It was the same color as the chair, but it was velvety instead of glossy. I went over to it and checked the back of my jeans for filth and sweat. I sat down on the very edge, then stood up to see if my soul had left a stain. She returned with a styrofoam cup of water.
Sit,
she said, stern this time. I sat. She handed me the water and I drank it.
I want you to lie down here and rest, she said.
I have to be somewhere, but I can't remember.
Work?
She asked. Shit, I said, closing my eyes and falling back against the couch. Its cushions felt like they were stuffed with mist. I'm going to get fired from ShopRite. I'm going to get fired from Barclays, too.
Don't worry about that. I can talk to your bosses.
Oh, yeah, I laughed. That always helps getting a job back, having your shrink call to say you were too fucked up to come to work today.
Don't worry about it, she told me again. Lie down.
I can't sleep anymore.
Just a minute.
She left again. I didn't want to listen to her, but the couch called to me to throw myself into it the same way fresh snowbanks did when I was a kid. I stretched out on it. I thought about my dirty boots too late. I had been here 10 minutes and already messed up her couch and her blouse. This was why she saw people like me in her other office wearing crappy clothes. She came back in with a refill on the water.
Here, she said, handing me a pill, too. It will help you sleep. It's one of my own.
You take pills? I asked. She nodded.
I thought you were well-adjusted.
A small smile passed over her lips. They had red lipstick on them. She never wore lipstick at the other office.
Define well-adjusted, she said.
I didn't like it. It bled into the old lady cracks around her lips. She stood up and walked to the door where she clicked off the light.
Try and get some rest, she said. I'll be doing some work in another room.
I swallowed the pill. I didn't even think about it. Enough light came through the window that I could still look around. I had been right about the books, hundreds of them. A lot of psychology stuff, but weird stuff too, stuck in between the academic-sounding titles. The Thousand Recipe Chinese Cookbook, The Art of Walt Disney, What to Expect When You're Expecting, Mass Media Law, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, The 185th Anniversary History of Laurel Falls, Ulysses, Peterson's Field Guide to Wildflowers, Black Beauty, In Cold Blood. I felt myself dozing off. I threw myself backward into the couch snowdrift and started flapping my arms and legs to make an angel. I kept falling and falling. The snow had no substance. Then I realized it was a cloud, and the angel I was making was a real one floating along behind me. She took my hand and we flew to a poor village, tranquil in an endless sea of sand beneath a bright white moon like one of Betty's pearls. We went from home to home, following a stream of crystal light that flew in and out of windows and went from bed to bed. It took me a while, but I finally figured out it was God cruising for chicks. I didn't understand. He was God. He knew what lurked in the hearts of men and women, too. He didn't have to search and test for someone willing. He knew. I asked the angel, and she explained that carnal love was the one emotion God couldn't read, an emotion too human for anyone to understand but man. She left me then at a window where a dark-haired girl lay sleeping naked on a bare cloth mattress, with her lips and legs parted, and her slender arms extended in a welcome. The moonlight spilled over her, seeping and gushing into every opening, every pore. Then I was back floating alone in my cloud drift. I couldn't get the girl out of my mind. I felt her fear and her bliss. I felt her regret at lost innocence. But I also felt her need to be ruined. She was a woman. He was God. He could have blinked and made a son, but he had gone to her instead. I bet it made her glow from the inside out. I bet it lifted her from the bed, writhing and smiling. I bet threads of silver light shot from her fingertips and toes and every strand of her hair. I hoped so. I hoped and prayed that it was so. It was her one lousy shot at ecstasy before she became the eternal virgin, and I hoped she got there. Betty's office was completely dark when I opened my eyes. It was like waking up inside ink. I rolled off the couch with a thud, and sat frozen on the floor with my heart pounding in my throat. I didn't want her to come back. She didn't. I stood up slowly and got my bearings. A dim sliver of light came from the hallway behind the cracked door. I went for the window instead. It unlocked easily and quietly. The moon was high overhead, shining brightly but giving off no light. I stared up at it. And New Callie was staring up at it too, thinking it was violent in its perfection, like a strong, quick stab with a sharpened stick. She was wondering where I was. The dream had cleared my head. It was good to dream again. I started walking, feeling a slapping, rhythmic calm beneath my feet, like the tiny waves that finally lap the shore after a distant motorboat has passed by. Betty's rich neighborhood dissolved around me, and I found myself walking a gray town sidewalk, past uniform shabby houses, pushed together in hedgerows of defeat.
I knew where I was. My dad used to point out these houses whenever we drove by them. He always said how glad he was we had our own little spot in the country and didn't have to live like this. I agreed. Isolated failure was easier to bear. It didn't take me long to get to Barclays, or maybe it did. I had lost my sense of time. I got in my truck and drove away. The whole way to Blacklick Road, I was only thinking about the release. Not the sex. Sex was too complicated and mental. I was thinking in vague, swirling grays of the mindlessness of instinct and the simple glories of physical stimuli. I suddenly understood how farm boys could do it with their sheep and daddies could do it with their daughters. They shrugged off their humanness like the shedding of a skin and became something new and raw and beautiful in their own ugly eyes. The only thing separating me from them was the fear that I would find something hideous and mangled under my skin. I didn't go home first. I left my truck on the side of the road after calculating the straightest shot through the woods to the mining office. I took a couple swats in the face with tree branches and twisted my ankle in a groundhog hole, but I knew she was waiting for me, worrying about me. I wondered if she had brought the stuff for s'mores. The light from the useless moon was enough to give a faint glimmer to the rocks around the train tracks. They stretched out like a sill of metal filings. I thought she might be sitting outside. I expected a flashlight beam or even a fire. I didn't know what time it was.
Maybe I was way too late. Maybe she was back home already.
I started walking faster. I broke into a jog. As I neared the office, I saw her backpack and her cooler. "Callie," I said. I was breathing a lot heavier than I needed to be. "Callie," I said again and stepped up to the door. The crunch of the gravel crackled inside my head like electrical pops. I peered into the gloom and saw a bare ankle ending in a foot and a woman's white tennis shoe.
It lay flat on its side, toe pointed outward, at an angle too uncomfortable for sleep and too unnatural for the living.
I moved an inch farther and saw the tips of her fingers curled up like a bird claw. Instinct dropped me to my knees. Self-preservation kept me from looking any further. Amber's psychos reared their heads all around me. Misty's demonic prancing unicorns filled the sky. Boyish banker Brad. Did he do it? What if he had found out about us? I wasn't there when Mom shot Dad. I'd never seen a dead person, except for my grandparents, who didn't count because they were old and unlovable. Dad's funeral had been closed casket. I never understood why, but now that I knew what Uncle Mike thought about him and Misty, I knew he had requested it because he couldn't stand to look at Dad again. It was a shame because Dad had been innocent and Uncle Mike had lost his brother a second time. I took a couple deep, breathless breaths. She might only be hurt, I told myself. I couldn't walk in. I stayed on my knees. My closeness to the ground gave me the confidence of a child covering his face with his hands and peeking through his fingers. "Callie," I whispered. "Please." I passed through the doorway and waited on all fours, staring at her dead feet. The vomit had already risen to my throat before I looked at the rest of her. I tried to make it outside but threw up next to her. I felt bad about that. Her face was gone. She didn't have a face. There was part of a jawbone with a couple teeth left and a shattered section of forehead. My retching turned into dry heaves that I didn't think were going to stop until they turned me inside out. It was dark, but I saw bone and flesh and brain and hair. I fixed my stare back on her feet, afraid to see any more. Afraid I might see her eyes, whole and unharmed, staring at me from a corner. I reached out and touched her ankle. It was freezing cold. I moved my hand over to her hand and tried to hold it. I started to cry then, not only out of grief, but out of relief, too. Now I knew for sure that people had souls. What I felt in her dead hand was much more than a loss of heat and blood. She was gone. She had been more than words and thoughts and feelings.
She had been an essence. She was somewhere else. That was all. And so was Dad. It wasn't over. Maybe there was still a chance for us. I decided to add him to my list of dead people I'd like to meet.
I picked up her hand and held it to my face and cried into it. It smelled like salami and mustard. She had made us sandwiches.
The footsteps outside didn't startle me. I knew they would come eventually. I didn't stop crying or holding Callie's hand. I knew she would wait for me. I put the hand down, stood up, and walked to the open door. Her calm, blasted stare settled over me, but she was shivering violently.
"I'm sorry,"
she said, and began a hacking, tearless sobbing.
"I didn't know what else to do."
I made a move like I meant to run at her, but nothing happened. My feet started inching forward. I urged them to go faster, but they were submerged in a dream or a sea. I finally arrived and took Uncle Mike's gun from her.
"What about me?"
she asked in a broken whisper. I wanted to tell her she was everything good about me and everything bad. She was my best intentions mixed with the reality of who I was. She was every promise I couldn't keep. But I couldn't explain it to her. All I could say was, "Amber," and nothing else would come. Her eyes were a bruised violet in the dark. A tranquil fear, like the realization of painless death, spread through me. All I could give her was what I had left. What I had left was under my skin. Chapter 20.
I stopped talking to the cops just because I'm tired. I'm pretty sure I'm done anyway. I don't know what time it is.
I always thought a police station would be covered with clocks. Time is very important to these guys. They begin all the reports with the time. They're always telling hysterical victims to take their time. They send criminals off to prison to do time. But I can't find a lousy clock anywhere. I think about asking the sheriff what time it is. He's wearing a nice watch. Not as nice as a banker's watch or a psychiatrist's watch, though. And that probably bugs the hell out of him because he knows what he does is more important, more dangerous, too. Bankers rarely get their brains blown out, although sometimes their wives do. I want to make a phone call, I think to say, and everybody looks at me like now I'm out of my mind. "We're not done," the sheriff says from where he's sitting on the edge of his desk. "I want to go over some of this before you sign it. Then you can make your call." Amber doesn't have good aim.
That was why Callie got her brains blown out. Standing 3 feet away from her, holding a gun with a high-powered telescopic sight, and Amber missed her chest and shot her in the face.
She apologized to me for that during the drive back to our house. She said she would have never done it on purpose. She knew Callie had a husband and kids and family and friends. She also promised me Callie didn't have time to be scared. "I want to make it now," I say. Bill, the deputy who belted me in the face earlier, makes another move for me, and the sheriff yells at him to back off. The metal-topped table in front of me is covered with balled-up white Kleenex soaked in bright red blood.
"All right," the sheriff says, and looks at his watch. "You've been here 2 hours. Make your call."
He heaves his couch-smelling bulk off the desk, turns to spit tobacco in an old coffee can the way my grandpa used to spit out the lining of his black lungs, and picks up the phone cradled in a cheap-looking plastic console with a dozen square buttons running down the side of it, some of them flashing red. He comes over and drops it in front of me.
"Can I have some privacy?"
I ask.
"No," he says.
"Doesn't that violate my civil rights or something like that?" He picks up the receiver and stabs one of the buttons.
"Probably,"
he says. I take the phone from him and he walks back to his desk. The other deputies yawn and stretch and go off in search of more coffee, except for Bill. He takes a seat a couple feet away and stares at me like he wants to break more than my nose. He must have known her. Maybe he stopped her for a speeding ticket once and they got to talking about impressionists. I dial my number.
It rings 4 times before Uncle Mike answers. He doesn't sound happy to hear from me.
I tell myself it's just because I'm calling so late, but tears start rolling down my cheeks anyway.
I want to talk to Jody.
Jody? He says. Jody's in bed, asleep.
There aren't any female deputies, so the sheriff had to dig up a Laurel Falls policewoman to send out to talk to the girls. She told them they had to be put in a shelter overnight until temporary foster care could be worked out for them, or they could stay with a relative. Amber called Uncle Mike.
Can you wake her up?
No, I can't, he says tensely. What are you doing calling here? Since when do the police let people call home from jail?
You get one phone call.
This is your one phone call?
Yeah.
There's a long silence.
Jesus, Harley, he says,
his voice all shaky like he might cry.
You might get the death penalty for this.
Tried as an adult. Tried as an adult flashes in front of me like a failing bar sign.
I know.
You get one phone call and you call a 6-year-old little girl?
Right.
More silence.
I'm sorry, he says, his voice tightening up again. I can't wake her.
What about Amber?
Everyone's asleep.
Well, I say slowly, staring at the neon bright words, wondering when something's going to finally appear there that won't go away.
I just wanted to make sure she's okay.
She's fine as she can be.
He pauses then.
You can't keep anything quiet in a small town, not for a second. People are already driving up here, shouting and throwing things on the yard, and it's the middle of the night.
Tomorrow should be pretty bad.
We're taking the girls back to our house first thing in the morning and getting them away from here.
What about Elvis?
I'm not taking your damn dog.
You've got to take him, I say. Who's going to feed him? If he starts roaming around looking for food, someone's going to shoot him. Or he could get hit by a car.
My panic starts mounting.
He's been a good dog. He deserves better. I don't care what he deserves. He's a dog, and I'm not taking him.
I start crying pretty hard. I don't even care that the sheriff and Deputy Bill are thinking I'm a pussy for doing it.
You have to get Jody a fortune cookie and a paper umbrella every month, I manage to tell him. Then I hang up. The sheriff comes back over, pushes the phone aside, and sits on the table close enough to me that I can see he's got a small, reddish-brown stain on the thigh of his gray law enforcement pants. It could be blood, but I'm willing to bet it's salsa. I reach for one of my bloody tissues since I used up the box they gave me, and blow my nose in it before I remember how bad my nose hurts. The pain makes me cry even harder. He's got no sympathy for me. I don't expect him to. He's got heavy-lidded eyes that remind me of a dozing turtle.
You know much about guns, Harley?
He asks me. It's the first time he's used my name all night. Usually he calls me son.
Some, I say.
I know you used to go hunting with your dad.
Not much. Enough to know how to handle a gun, he says. Enough to know how to aim and shoot. Enough to know how powerful a 44 Magnum carbine is and what kind of damage it can do at close range.
He gets up and starts walking. I'm glad. I don't like the way he smells or looks. His belt and holster and cheap shoes creak as he paces.
My question to you is, why didn't you shoot her from a distance? You got a nice scope on that Ruger. You don't have to be a good shot with a scope like that, just aim and pull the trigger.
I don't say anything. He stops, stares at me for a moment, then starts pacing again.
You could have climbed one of those hills up behind the railroad tracks and shot her in her front yard while she was outside playing with her kids. Or you could have shot her right through all those windows on the front of their house.
He stops again.
You know her kids, right?
He asks me, even though he knows I do.
Her little girl is friends with that sister of yours you just called, right? It's probably going to be hard for them to be friends from now on, huh? I know what he's doing. I just don't understand why he's doing it. Someone's been killed, and here I am admitting to it. He's got a murder victim. He's got a murderer. Why mess with that? No one questioned my mom's story. My hands start shaking again. I sit on them. Hell, if you had done it that way, you could have said it was a hunting accident and not gone to jail at all. He starts walking and talking again.
It happens all the time. No one would have suspected anything because nobody knew what was going on between you two, right? Nobody knew. I know her husband didn't know.
Did you tell him? I ask, suddenly feeling queasy.
One of the other deputies comes walking back with two steaming styrofoam cups of coffee.
No, the sheriff says, taking a cup from him.
I haven't been out of this room since I found out myself. I talked to him after we recovered the body, though, and he was stunned that we had you in custody. He said you liked his wife and that she was fond of you. She felt sorry for you. He said you had come by their house just a couple days ago all upset from visiting your mom in prison on your birthday, and she went out to your truck in the pouring rain and talked to you and made you feel better.
He takes a sip of his coffee. Did she make you feel better, Harley?
I stare at the bloody Kleenex. The smell from his coffee is making me feel sicker.
I guess she won't be making you feel better anymore.
Shut up,
I shout, surprised by my own words. I'm also surprised to find myself standing. This time Bill doesn't come after me, the other one does. He's the one who brought up the death penalty earlier, during my confession. I told him how beautiful she was, and he pointed out how killing a beautiful woman, especially a mother of young kids, was the worst crime there was aside from killing the kids. He said I was going to fry for it, even though he's a cop, so I'm sure he knows Pennsylvania uses lethal injection. What he means is, I'll be inoculated for it. I asked him if I'd still get the death penalty if she was fat and ugly, and he said I'd probably only get life.
He's also the guy who told me I watched too much TV when I called about my mom. I recognize his voice.
He clamps a big hand on my shoulder, and I wince the same way Amber did when I touched her shoulder tonight. When she took her clothes off, she had a bruise there. That Ruger packs a kick.
I want to go to jail, I cry out to all of them.
The deputy holding me looks over at the sheriff, who nods at him. He lets go.
I want to go now, I say.
Okay, fair enough, the sheriff agrees.
I've just got one more question for you. Then you can sign your confession and we'll put you in a cell here, and a couple hours from now, when lawyers and judges start their days, we'll get you to a real jail.
He tells me to sit down. I keep standing.
Why'd you kill her? He asks.
Huh?
Why'd you kill her? I start feeling panicky again. I think about Elvis and how he's going to think I've run out on him on purpose, and how he's going to spend the rest of his life thinking he's a bad dog. I think about Jody and Esme and how the sheriff's right, they can't be friends anymore. I think about Amber and how she cried and cried when we were done, because it wasn't what she wanted after all, and now she knows.
What do you mean? I asked him.
From everything you've told me so far, I'd say you were in love with her. Now, I'm not saying people don't kill people they love. That happens around here almost as much as hunting accidents. But they usually have a pretty good reason for doing it.
I lick my lips. I wanted to marry her, I say. It isn't a lie.
And? He urges.
She wouldn't leave her husband.
So you killed her?
Yeah.
Okay.
He sits down on his desk again. He takes another drink of his coffee and places it next to his spit can.
Let me make sure I've got this straight one last time, he says, and rubs at his chin like he's an intellectual. You're supposed to be meeting her to get fucked, and instead you show up with a gun you know can literally blow her head off, and you stand there face to face with the woman you love, close enough to see the terror in her eyes, and you do it. You blow her head off instead of fucking her. That's what you choose to do. Then you throw up beside her and fold her hands peacefully over her chest. You get in your truck, drive to the police station, turn yourself in, give us a nice, neat confession, then call home to see how your dog and baby sister are doing. Is that about right? My head aches. My face hurts. My scalp itches. My stomach is heaving. My hands are shaking. The blood is pounding so heavy in my ears, his final words are drowned out by the sound. "Here's my only problem," he goes on. "One of the people you've described is a cold-blooded, homicidal psychopath. The other is a decent, responsible kid who's had a really shitty life. Can you explain to me how you can be both?" Groovy rises up from his spit can like a genie coming out of his lamp.
It spreads across the room in pink and purple cloud letters. "I have a split personality," I tell him, licking my lips some more.
"Is that why you see a shrink?
Something like that."
Amber had been wearing watermelon lip smacker tonight, the stuff she's worn since she was a kid. I could swear I still tasted it.
"Then she can confirm this. I can ask her. What's her name again? I'd like to talk to her anyway."
I only kissed her once, and I told her I couldn't do it again. I couldn't touch her either. She didn't care. I put my hands in the dirt beneath her. "I want to go to jail now. You said I could."
"All right, Harley."
He brings me a 3-page police report with tons of writing on it. At the very top is the time we started. He leans over with a pen and fills in the time we ended, then hands the pen to me. He flips to the last page.
"Sign here," he tells me.
He's looking at me differently than anyone's looked at me all night. Not with hatred, outrage, or disgust. Not even with pity or frustration. He's disappointed in me. I don't like the guy, but still I crave understanding from someone. I had to do it, I wanted to tell him. I had to give her that one shot at ecstasy. That's what the dream was telling me. Too bad she didn't get there. But I don't think most people ever do. At least she got the desire out of her system, and now she's going to be okay. That's why I don't want her life getting fucked up by going to jail. She's going to be okay now. I'm not, even though I've already blocked out most of it. I don't remember anything except I know I didn't ejaculate. The problem with trying to forget about shit is you can't. Time does not heal all wounds. I don't know who was the first guy to say it does, but it couldn't have been Confucius. He would have never said something so stupid. I sign. A confession's a confession. The sheriff takes the pen from me, then says something kind of weird.
"I'm sorry, son," he tells me. "I know that you must have loved her."
I don't bother telling him I still do. I'm not going to stop just because she killed someone. Epilogue. This place is not so bad. It has a great view. A bank calendar view. Miles and miles of soft green hills that look like they'd make a great bed if a giant came stumbling through the valley and needed a place to crash. The food could be better, and so could the company, but I'm not very hungry or social these days, so it doesn't matter much. I haven't been allowed to have visitors yet, but my new shrink says I should be able to see Jody soon. She's the only person I want to see, only because I want her to see that I'm okay. Betty wants to see me, but I don't want to see her. I'm still mad at her for turning in Amber. I know she thought she was doing what was best for all of us, but it wasn't her place to make that decision. I had my reason for doing what I did. I told her this when I saw her in the police station the day after my arrest, and she said she knew I had my reason, but it wasn't a good one. I didn't kill Callie Mercer. Choosing to sleep with me may have ultimately, unwittingly led to the circumstances that ended her life, but I did not pull the trigger. Then she said I would be cheating Amber by taking the blame for her crime. She took a human life. She took a mother from her children, a wife from her husband, a daughter from her parents. She needed to be punished if she was ever going to have closure. I have closure on my wall now. My new shrink told me to write down the words I see in the air. I have a ton of them taped up. We're allowed to have tape in here. We don't have to use tapioca. I have a ton of Jody's fortunes taped up, too. She sent me her whole fortunes envelope. Every time I look at one, I picture her carefully pulling out the strip of paper as delicately as if she were straightening a fairy's wings. And I feel a little better before I feel really shitty. She sent me a letter, too. I've only been able to read it once, but I'm going to keep it forever because I know how much work she put into it. I've started a dozen letters back to her, and they all begin with how proud I am of her letter. I never get around to finishing them, though. Hers says, "Dear Harley, how are you? I'm fine. Misty is fine, too. Uncle Mike let me bring all my dinosaurs to his house. He said I can get a new one for Christmas. I pray every night for you and Amber and Esme's mom's soul. I hope you will come home soon. I miss my life. Your sister, Jody." I still have Skip's letter, too. I keep it in my one drawer with some other stuff. They're pretty good about letting you keep personal effects here as long as they fit in the drawer. Callie's art book wouldn't fit, which is okay because I think it was only a loaner. I've got Mom's Bible and her map in the drawer, too, and Mom and Dad's wedding picture, and the crocheted doll. They let me keep her because they don't know what I use her for. I don't think I'm ever going to want a live woman again. The only other thing in here is a card from Church. I know he picked it out himself because the front is a cartoon dog wearing a party hat, shouting, "Congratulations." The inside says, "Way to go. I knew you could do it." I know his mom would have guided him in a different direction if they had shopped for a card together. I have a feeling Church's mom doesn't think I'm such a nice boy anymore. I'm not exactly sure what would have led her to that conclusion. Amber's story made the 11 o'clock news, not mine. It turned out I wasn't sent to jail for murder after all. And the only reason I'm in here is because I started laughing when they told me Misty was the one who told the police Amber and I had an incestuous relationship. And I couldn't stop laughing. Or maybe I was screaming. I don't remember. The only thing I do remember is shitting myself. Shitting yourself in front of strangers and fucking your sister are two things you don't ever forget. At least Betty hasn't turned her back on me like Church's mom. Sometimes I think I shouldn't be so hard on her for that reason alone. And to tell the truth, if I'm going to be mad at her for the whole Amber mess, I should be mad at Elvis, too. True. Betty was the one who went to the sheriff's department when she heard about my arrest and told them I had been at her office until almost midnight the night before, and I couldn't have done it. But on its own, that really wouldn't have meant anything. I still would have had time to kill Callie. I didn't show up at the police station until almost 2 a.m. She asked them if they had talked to my sister, but that wouldn't have meant anything either. They already had my signed confession. They decided to go out to the house anyway, and the way the sheriff explained it to me was no one was there except for a big shepherd mutt lying on an old, burnt-up couch, chewing on a pair of girls' cutoffs, spattered in blood. Amber wasn't any better at burying than she was at aiming. I was upset all over again when I heard Uncle Mike had really gone through with it and just left Elvis there. Betty wouldn't take him either. I came pretty close to begging. I even asked the sheriff and a couple of the deputies to take him. Betty did end up finding a home for him, though. She told me he's living with a nice family. They live in town, so he doesn't have as much space as he's used to, but he's still very happy. Bullshit, I told her. He wakes up every day and looks around him and wonders what terrible thing he did that would make the one person in his life who was supposed to love him unconditionally turn his back on him. That's what he thinks, I told her. I don't care that he's only a dog. I do a lot of thinking myself these days, but only on select topics. I guess that's the way I've always been. My new shrink says that's okay, He says that's not my biggest problem. He says my biggest problem is when I accidentally start thinking about things I don't want to think about. I can't cope. Earthcrossers. I told him that's what I call them. He loved that. He told me it was a brilliant analogy. He's always lying his head off like that. I asked him once if he got a book with a chapter in it called Compliment Psychos and They Will Be Your Friends. He laughed and told me I'm very witty and perceptive. I said I was being serious. I guess some of what he says is true, though. I still can't think about Misty without screaming. I can't think about what has become of little Zach and Esme Mercer's lives. I can't think about Jody's notes. I can't think about Callie's 6 seconds. I've always figured when a mother sees the big one coming and the sky light up like 1,000 suns, she sees her children's faces in every one of them. Callie would have thought about her kids as she faced down Amber. She wouldn't have thought about herself, not her boyish banker husband or the grandfather who gave her the hills she loved, not me or the god she was on her way to see. She would have thought about her kids and how they were going to wake up in the middle of the night for years to come, calling for her, and she wouldn't be able to get to them. She's going to hear them, too, no matter where she ends up, heaven, hell, or some netherworld in between. She's going to hear them call to her. That's the worst part about the whole thing, damning Callie and her kids to that fate. They deserve better. Them and Elvis. The biggest surprise is I can think about Amber now. Not everything, but some of it. I try to think positively when I think about her future. It would be nice if she had one of those trials like OJ's, where everybody knows she did it, but they let her go anyway because they don't like the prosecutor's hairstyle. But that shit only happens on TV.
I can think about our childhood again. And I can even think about her snuggled up against my back in bed at night, and how that may have been the only calm she will ever feel in her entire life.
My new shrink says that particular memory isn't healthy for me, because I'm only remembering part of it. I'm not remembering the whole truth. And he knows how hung up I am on the truth. He's seen my room. I guess I see truth in the air a lot. I've written it down about 100 times and taped it to my wall. Those who know the truth are not equal to those who love it. Confucius said that. I've written that down too. I guess I always thought I was someone who loved the truth, but constantly had it hidden from me. Now I realize I've always had a lot of truth staring me in the face, but I've ignored it on purpose because I don't love it. The truth is the truth sucks sometimes. People are the only ones who care about that. The only thing separating me from Elvis isn't my ability to face or deal with or deny it. It's that I let it bother me. I'm trying really hard to stop, because the truth is, I've already wasted so much of my life lying to myself. The truth is all those times Skip tried to kill his brother Donnie, I thought he was being a real asshole.
This concludes the reading of Backroads by Tawny O'Dell. Copyright 2000 by Tawny O'Dell. This book was read by Andrew Iden. This unabridged audiobook was recorded by arrangement with Viking, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC, and was produced in 2015 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.